On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with University of Virginia's Dr. Jim Tucker about his new book, Return to Life, Extraordinary Cases of Children Who Remember Past Lives.
So we've got over 2,500 cases from essentially all over the world. Wherever anyone has looked for cases, they've been found. What we started doing a number of years ago now was coding each case on 200 variables and putting them into a database for analysis. So then you can look at patterns in the cases that you can't see just on an individual level. So for instance, we know that in 70% of the cases, the previous person died by unnatural means, meaning murder, suicide, accident. So that certainly seems to be a distinct factor in these cases.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, an interview that's long overdue. Dr. Jim Tucker joins us to talk about his new book and his research into children with memories of past lives. This research being conducted at the University of Virginia, a continuation of the work done by Dr. Ian Stevenson, is among the most compelling evidence for survival of consciousness that we have. The cases are compelling, the research methodology is rock solid, and the researcher behind the work, Dr. Jim Tucker, is equally impressive. Today we welcome Dr. Jim Tucker to Skeptico. Dr. Jim Tucker, MD, is Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia, where he's continued and further advanced the work of Dr. Ian Stevenson, who studied children who report memories of previous lives. Jim is here to talk about his new book, Return to Life, Extraordinary Cases of Children Who Remember Past Lives. Dr. Tucker, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks for joining me.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So, Jim, it's a very interesting book. I think a lot of people find it a great read. It's fascinating. A lot of cases in it. You start off the book with a case which is also, in a way, a tribute to Ian Stevenson. Can you tell folks a little bit about Dr. Stevenson, and in particular, your experiences with him, how you came to meet him, what he was like?
Yeah, Ian Stevenson was the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry here at the University of Virginia. When he became intrigued by these reports of cases from various parts of the world of young children reporting memories of past lives, and he started studying them in the early 60s, eventually stepped down his chair to study these cases full-time, and spent the bulk of the last 40 years of his career focused on these cases. I got involved in the late 90s. I had done my psychiatry training here at UVA, but I didn't meet him during that time. But after I went into private practice, I learned more about his work and became intrigued by it, and initially just came on here as on a voluntary basis to help out with the research before coming on as a full-fledged faculty member. And with Ian, he was always very precise in the work and completely devoted to it. The amount of miles he traveled and the amount of time he put into this work was really quite remarkable. But he was also a very gracious person. Initially, he could be a bit formal at times, really in the way that he used language so precisely. But he could also be quite warm and supportive. He was quite supportive of my initial steps in the field. And he left behind, when he died in 2007, left behind quite a legacy for people to try to carry on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, quite a legacy in a couple of different ways. You know, I've talked to several folks on Skeptico, guests who have really been transformed, I guess is the only word you can say, by his work. I mean, hardcore academic, logical people who say, hey, you know, I encountered this research and I really had to re-examine what I believed because it was done so well. But, you know, in your telling of his biography, the synopsis of that 40 years, it almost makes it sound like there was this clear road that didn't have any bumps in it. And that is not the case. And of course, I think a lot of people look at your work that you do there at UVA and Dr. Stevenson's work and are in awe that you guys were able to get this done and you can still get it done. Can you add anything to that in terms of what it's been like to keep this very controversial, some would say fringy science going?
Well, the road is certainly a lot smoother for me than it was for Ian initially. It happened because there were people who were interested in it enough to help fund his time and to fund the expenses of the work. And a big one was Chester Carlson, who invented the Xeroxing process and, of course, is quite wealthy. And that allowed for an endowment to be created, which really has funded the work ever since. But even so, there were initially people who were at the university who were quite negative about Ian's work and didn't want it to happen here. But cooler heads prevailed, and people saw that it was serious-minded, even if it was a topic that people might find strange. It was certainly serious-minded work. And by the time I came along, there are still sort of issues that come up, but we basically fund ourselves, and with the help of generous donors, but we're not costing anyone any money. And the university has been always tolerant and in certain circumstances even supportive of this work. So it goes on, and hopefully it will continue on indefinitely.
I like the way you termed it there, serious-minded research. Why don't you tell folks a little bit about this research and in particular the methodology? Okay, so we all know the basic story. There's children who report memories of past lives. So a case like that arrives in your inbox. I'm sure you get a lot of those at this point because you are world famous, world renowned for this research. How does it go from there? What is the research methodology and how do you make sure you're really getting the good stuff in this research?
Yeah. Well, the approach is always one of being open-minded about it. We've never approached these cases as from a dogmatic standpoint or if I may use the term, a New Age standpoint where someone believes in reincarnation and then they approach a case as the premise being that it's a case of reincarnation. That's not how we operate. We approach a case to see how much evidence it provides that there is this connection with the past life. So, yeah, when I get an email or a letter from a parent, and we do get a lot of them these days, what I'm most interested in are cases where the child has given enough details where there's the opportunity to see if they can be validated or verified. So we get a lot from children who some of say really some quite interesting things, but if they don't give names of people or places, then it's quite a curiosity, but not really anything more than that. But then we get the cases where the children do give details that can be verified. So there are some in my book that are quite interesting, and one that's gotten a lot of press is James Leininger, where a boy gave a lot of details about being a World War II pilot. And we have documentation that was made of his statements before the pilot was identified that shows that what the child said, including a number of quite specific details, all matched perfectly with the only person that they could have matched with. And in a case like that, then it provides evidence that there was this link to a past life and that little James Leininger seemed to have memories from somebody's life who lived and died before.
Yeah, that's an amazing case, and it's really documented nicely in the book. For folks who haven't heard about it, can you maybe take us back and start from the beginning there and tell us the whole thing? It's a great story.
Yeah, it's a little boy, son of a Christian couple in Louisiana who as a little fella, liked his toy planes, but around the time of his second birthday, also started having horrific nightmares 4 or 5 times a week of a terrible plane crash, and he would be kicking his legs up in the air, screaming, "Airplane crash on fire, little man can't get out," and these were going on night after night. And then during the day, he would take his little toy planes and say, "Airplane crash on fire," and slam them into the family's coffee table repeatedly, where there were dozens of scratches and dents.
Not the normal kind of two-year-old playing around. The kid is obsessed with these airplanes, right?
Well, that's right, and not just obsessed, and also seemingly traumatized. I mean, this is not playing around. This is a kid who looks like he's, in those features, looks like he has post-traumatic stress disorder. And then during the day, he started talking some about his plane crash, and he said how he had been a pilot, and he had flown off of a boat, and he even gave the name of a boat. He said Natoma. And he said that he had flown a type of plane called a Corsair, and that he had been shot down by the Japanese and shot down at Iwo Jima, and that he had a friend on the boat named Jack Larson. Well, his dad, who was a firm Christian who thought the idea of past lives was nonsense, started looking into this to show that there was nothing to it. But then he learned that, in fact, there had been an American aircraft carrier in World War II called the USS Natoma Bay. And we've got documentation that James was 28 months old when he gave the word Natoma. So there was this USS Natoma Bay. It was involved in the Iwo Jima operation, and it lost one pilot there, a young man from Pennsylvania named James Houston. Houston's plane crashed exactly as James Leininger described. It got hit in the engine, burst into flames, crashed in the water, and quickly sank, which is exactly what James described. Houston, the pilot, had in fact flown a Corsair, as James Leininger mentioned. And on the day that he was killed, the pilot of the plane next to his was named Jack Larson, which is another detail that James Leininger had given. And all of these things that I've given you, again, we've got documentation both. We've got documentation that was made before Houston's pilot was identified, and it all matched perfectly with, again, the one pilot from that ship that went down at the Iwo Jima operation, so the only person that it could match with, and it matched precisely.
From a 28-month-old boy, I mean, those of us who have had kids, I mean, there's just no way to explain that in any ordinary terms. It's not like his parents had any kind of background in aviation or World War II buffs or anything like that, right?
Yeah, and in fact, when he said Natoma, his dad said, "Well, that sounds Japanese to me." And James said, "No, it was American." And, I mean, no one, I don't care if you're a military buff or what, is going to know these details. And, I mean, unless you were involved in the Iwo Jima operation or were on the Natoma Bay, I mean, this, you know, it's a sort of a nondescript escort carrier. And when World War II, obviously, was a huge operation with thousands of ships like this, and there's no way a 28-month-old had access to that information.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And of course, the other part that's remarkable is the breadth of your work. I mean, so this case then is not an isolated case. It fits into this huge body that you've collected. Tell folks a little bit about that body of work, and in particular, the database that you've created and how that fits into your investigation of these past lives.
Yeah, so, you know, Ian started studying these cases in the early 60s, and the work has continued ever since. It's been 50 years now. So we've got over 2,500 cases from essentially all over the world. Wherever anyone has looked for cases, they've been found. Now, they're easiest to find in cultures with a belief in reincarnation, but they're found everywhere. And what we started doing a number of years ago now was coding each case on 200 variables and putting them into a database for analysis. And it's taken us years to get the cases in. We still haven't quite finished, but we've got over 2,000 of them in the database now. So then you can look at patterns in the cases that you can't see just on an individual level. So for instance, we know that in 70% of the cases, previous person died by unnatural means, meaning murder, suicide, accident, war. So that certainly seems to be a distinct factor in these cases. We also know that even in the natural death cases, that the people tend to die quite early, where a quarter of the natural death cases is under the age of 15. So again, there's something about dying an unnatural death or dying young that makes it more likely that these memories will then appear down the road. So those are the kinds of things that we can use the database to try to learn more about exactly how this whole process takes place.
That's amazing. Any other insights that you've gotten from that database, in particular about maybe the age that these memories seem to surface or anything along those lines?
Well, they surface very early. It's usually around the age of 2 or 3 that the average age is about 38 months, so just past the third birthday. And another interesting thing as far as figures go is that the children tend to talk about very recent lives. So the average interval between the death of the previous person and the birth of the child is only 4.5 years. But that's because you've got exceptions like James Langer that's 50 years. The median interval, meaning half or less and half or more, is only 16 months. So that for the most part, these kids are talking about really recent lives. So the picture that comes about is that there's somebody who dies prematurely, either by the mode of death or the age of death, and then comes back very quickly or stays in this realm or however you want to conceptualize, and then these memories appear soon after the person died.
Fascinating. You know, and it's also kind of a minefield of assumptions that you'd have to make and then possibly challenge. I very much appreciate how you said these memories seem to emerge, because we can't necessarily, correct me if I'm wrong, but we can't necessarily know for sure that there's a perfect correlation between these memories occurring and the past life being a reality. So I guess what I'm trying to say is what you're studying is the phenomena of these recollections, these memories, that doesn't necessarily speak to how often or what percentage of people are reincarnated and those kind of questions that people really want to answer, correct?
Well, sure. And I mean, I could say purported memories every time I say memories. So
right.
If we use the term memories, it doesn't necessarily mean that memory is valid, but I mean, the person has a memory, whether it's accurate or not. These cases don't speak to the question of whether everybody comes back, even if you accept them on face value. In fact, these may well be the exception in the sense that, like I was just saying, it's usually people who died violently or died young. So maybe the usual pattern is for the consciousness, even if it survives, to have some completely different kind of experience. But in these cases, it seems that it sort of stays attached to this realm or again, however you want to view it. But in any case, that quite quickly, a child is born who then reports memories of that life.
I'm glad you threw in the purported claims of memories thing, because as much as we'd like to, we can't ignore the debunker skeptical side of this, which is really the reason we can't ignore it is because it is the mainstream view, right? I mean, you sit there at UVA and you're allowed to do this work, but the majority of the campus community there hasn't fully embraced this idea, no matter how overwhelmingly suggestive this evidence seems to be. You know, one of the most frequent claims that you hear from the debunking crowd is that this can all be explained by cultural bias. You touched on that in the sense that your research seems to indicate that this is more likely to occur from your studies in cultures that believe in reincarnation. But I think you told me the last time we talked that this book really focuses on more U.S., North American cases and kind of seeks to kind of challenge that assumption a little bit, because you do have some good U.S.-based cases. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. I mean, this new book is almost all American cases. And, yeah, I mean, they disprove the idea that this is a cultural phenomenon. I mean, whatever the explanation is, it's not cultural factors, because these are taking place in families without a belief in reincarnation and in our culture without a belief in reincarnation. So there's certainly more to it than that. And it's beginning to look like that these cases are more common than we have known. So we're in the process of crunching the numbers of a survey study we've recently done with a number of counties in Virginia, asking families if they have had a child who's talked about a past life. And of parents of kids ages 3 to 12, 6% of the households said that they had a child who talked about a past life.
Wow.
Now, that doesn't mean that the memories were validated, obviously, because presumably they weren't. But this is a phenomenon that is not simply a cultural creation. It seems to be more of a human phenomenon that happens, and then we can explore why it happens or how it happens. And, you know, I use purported memories not just because of sort of the mainstream critics, but also I continue to approach each case as an open question. You know, what is the evidence that this case provides that there's a past life connection? And sometimes I'm impressed by it, and sometimes I'm not.
And that's interesting what you just said a minute ago, because it would suggest, and it's kind of an aha moment as soon as you said it, but that the cultural bias may be in the reporting more than anything else. So we have a cultural bias that underreports this phenomena, and that's why we see the disparity between the Southeast Asian cases and the U.S. cases.
Well, exactly. It's sampling error, basically. I mean, in a lot of cultures, if kids are talking about this stuff, then word gets out because families will talk about it. Whereas here, when we've talked with parents where they haven't even told the grandparents about it because, you know, it seems kind of weird, and people don't want their friends and neighbors to think that their kid is strange. So it's certainly easier to find cases in Thailand or India or wherever, but exactly how often they're happening there compared to here, we don't really know.
And the other thing that you touched on briefly is the religious overlay on this. Of course, this does challenge some assumptions for Christian believers, but it sounds like some of the parents that you're involved with are able to overcome that and brave enough to say, hey, I have to deal with my child and what they're going through and kind of set aside maybe some preconceived religious ideas I have. I love how you explore that in one of the chapters in the book. I think it's chapter 5, a story about Ryan, who again is a kid who has parents who really don't want to believe this reincarnation story, but they feel compelled to. It's a great story, a great case. I shouldn't call it a story, because the extent to which you research it, which anyone will find out if they read the book and read some of the scholarly papers you publish on this, you'll see it's really an extensive case study analysis that you do. But can you tell us a little bit about Ryan's story?
Sure, and yeah, Ryan is one, again, of a pair of Christian parents, and he's a little boy in Oklahoma who started telling his mom about a life in Hollywood he had, and he was crying about it every day. And eventually he pointed to a man in a picture from an old movie and said, hey, that's me, that's who I was. And he also pointed to another guy and said, hey, that's George, we did a movie together. And then pointed to himself and said, pointed to another man and said, hey, that's me. Well, the George he pointed to was George Raft, who was a movie star but back in the 20s and 30s, and or 30s and 40s, I guess. The other guy that he pointed to was an extra who had no lines in the movie. So his mom emailed me or actually wrote me a letter to see if I could help in identifying him. And eventually, with the help of a Hollywood archivist, we were able to identify that man. Well, meanwhile, Ryan is saying all kinds of things about his past life. He said how he had danced in New York, and then he'd gone to Hollywood, he'd been in movies, and then he had worked for an agency, and how he had seen the world on big boats, and how he had this big house with a swimming pool. All of this stuff seemed quite unlikely to me for an extra with no lines in the movie. But it turned out this fellow was a guy named Marty Martin, and his life, in fact, did match those details. He danced on Broadway, then he went to Hollywood. He was in movies and then started a talent agency, which was quite successful. And Marty Martin went to Europe on the Queen Mary and had fancy cars and did have a big house and a swimming pool. And Ryan had said that the street address had the word rock or mount in it, and Marty Martin's house was on Roxbury. So again, it was a case where there were a lot of specific details that were clearly documented, and then once the previous person was identified, the details meshed in a way that there'd been, it's inconceivable that Ryan could have learned all this through some normal means.
Yes, indeed. It's another great story, great case, and the book is full of them, and they're fascinating reads, and I think anyone is going to just enjoy and be totally drawn into them. They're really well written, too. The part of the book I really enjoyed getting to was the last part of the book, where you talk about what all this means. And there's a quote from there that I wanted you to kind of maybe expound on a little bit, because you say, the world exists as a shared dream, or you kind of speculate, perhaps the world exists as a shared dream, and that's what you've maybe taken away from this research. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, it's a little complicated, but you know, I spend a chapter exploring quantum physics, and quantum physics can be used by people sort of superficially sort of to back New Age beliefs. But what I try to do is show how people arrive at conclusions as Max Planck, the founder of quantum theory, did, when he said that he regarded consciousness as fundamental and that physical matter was derived from it. And I show why people can think this. And eventually it appears that on the quantum level, on the smallest, most basic level of the universe, that events only occur once their results are observed. So before observation, there are only potentials. There's not an outcome until it's observed, which is analogous to our nighttime dreams, where there are all these potential figures from our life that could be in the dreams, but they only exist in that world once we observe them. And it seems, in some strange way, that reality is very similar to that. And this leads to an idea that again, the consciousness is what's fundamental in reality, and then the physical universe is simply grows out of that. Well, if that's the case, then we would not expect an individual consciousness to end when a physical brain dies. And our cases, of course, provide evidence, in fact, consciousness does not end, and that it continues on. And I then explore, and it's speculative, but I explore that if you use that metaphor, then what might we say about existence after we die? And what other shared dreams might be possible, and what they might be like, and who might be in them, and so forth. So it's an idea that I think is worth exploring.
Well, definitely is, and I love the way that you do bridge from quantum physics, which often sends people in the wrong direction because so many people have rather new age-ish ideas that they attach to quantum mechanics and quantum theory, and they don't really fit it together very well. But I think you do a nice job of just kind of sticking with the basics of quantum physics and then bridging from there and trying to reconcile this fundamental question, which is really at the core, I think, of all this, which is, what is the nature of consciousness? And I think where your work, as you just said, leads us is that we do have to take seriously this alternative idea that consciousness is fundamental. And it's so funny because, as you just described, when you jump over to that position, so many of these seemingly impossible to solve questions kind of start opening up in a way and start looking much more understandable, at least from our limited perspective here.
Well, that's right. So I think really we have to look at reality differently in order to fully understand the cases. When you can't just map these cases on, obviously, onto a materialist understanding of the world. But I think if you stop and consider, it's not just that the world is primary and sort of consciousness is sort of bouncing from one life to the next or whatever. I don't think that's how it works. But if you consider that consciousness is the primary thing, and then this world that we see is just a creation of that consciousness, then it does give you a different perspective of sort of trying to understand what this is all about.
Yeah, but that's a big step from where we're at, isn't it? I mean, science does seem to be marching along with this kind of materialistic, blockheaded mindset that is very resistant to change. On the back of your book, you have some nice blurbs from folks who are, again, suggesting that maybe this book can help bust that paradigm, move us to a new paradigm, a new vista where we can see things differently. What do you think about that? What do you think in particular about the chances that during your career you'll see that kind of shift? You'll see science opening up in a real important way to these ideas that lie beyond scientific materialism.
Well, I think there's a very good chance that I'll have to wait until another lifetime for that to happen.
That'll have to be that memory, huh?
But, I do think that quantum theory, quantum physicists are open to some pretty wild things. And I think, I mean, they've already established that in many ways the world doesn't work the way that we think it does. That Newtonian kind of physics works great most of the time, but it's really an approximation. It's not an accurate view of reality. And, maybe there will continue to be big steps. And I don't have enough arrogance to think my book is going to lead to a breakthrough and suddenly society accepts the idea of consciousness as primary. But hopefully, if it happens, it'll happen in the quantum physics arena, and hopefully there will be continued breakthroughs. Just, the Einsteinian changes with relativity and all that, and to some extent the quantum theory showed us that we didn't understand what we thought we did. And perhaps there will be new advances that will again show people that the world does not work the way we think it does, and that it's not, the physical matter is not all that's important.
Jim, finally, you're there in, I guess you'd have to say, the Bible Belt to a certain extent. How is your work received by religious folks, mainstream religious folks? Because it certainly is, dogma busting for those guys, too. How do people reconcile some of this stuff?
Well, it varies, and you never know who's going to be open to it. I mean, there was a Harris poll a few years ago that showed that 20% of American Christians actually believe in reincarnation. Now, it tends to be a private belief that they're not talking about in church. But, the other thing I would say is that this work at least challenges or questions the idea of scientific materialism. So in that sense, it's a fellow traveler with religious folks. I mean, it's
right.
Taking the idea of consciousness and even the question of survival after death, it's taking those things seriously, which obviously much of science and medicine does not do. So I have not gotten angry emails from evangelical Christians or anything like that. And in fact, like in some of our families, or folks like that. So I think I think people can be open to interesting things from all sorts of perspectives, religious or otherwise.
Yeah, I would very much agree. And I think that the way that the cultural battle lines are drawn between science and religion are really a distortion of where most people sit. And I think the real issue is, as you just said, this idea of scientific materialism and its atheistic underpinnings versus people who want to explore if they are more than, you know, these biological robots that they're told they are. And I think most people intuitively and through experience know that they're more. And I think that's why they're drawn to this work, even if it violates the strict letter of the dogma doctrine that they get on Sunday.
Well, yeah, and it's, you know, a lot of people, well, to some extent in science, but certainly in medicine, I mean, a lot of people are religious, but they just separate out that, they sort of compartmentalize that part of their life with their work of trying to help people with physical illnesses. But it's something that obviously many people value. And this work, while it may challenge some of the specifics, I think overall is certainly not an enemy of people who value spirituality.
Jim, where does this research go from here? What are your plans?
Well, I would like to continue to study strong American cases. I think, you know, there are a number in my book, but I think the larger we can make that collection, the harder it will be for people to ignore. We're also going to continue to work with the database and see sort of what we can learn about the patterns of this whole process. And I hope, and not being able to be too specific, but I hope to continue to explore this issue of consciousness or mind and what it means and what it may mean about reality and just sort of continue to consider the big questions while also working on the individual cases or working with the database.
Great. Well, it's fantastic research. Really commend you for doing it and having the perseverance that you do. I think it's tremendous. Again, the book is Return to Life, Extraordinary Cases of Children Who Remember Past Lives. Our guest has been Dr. Jim Tucker from the University of Virginia. Thanks again so much for joining me, Jim.
Thanks very much for a great conversation.
Thanks again to Dr. Jim Tucker for joining me on Skeptico. I guess I have one question I tee up from this interview, and that is, where do you think this evidence stands relative to the other evidence we've looked at for survival of consciousness or just for extended human consciousness? So on this show, we've looked at near-death experience, medium communication, psi, out-of-body experience, and various other reported phenomena. Where do you think these past live memories, particularly among children, how do you think that stacks up vis-a-vis the other ones I just mentioned? So if you have some thoughts on that, you'd like to share them with me, I'd love to hear them. The place to do that, of course, is through the Skeptico Forum at skeptiko.com. There you'll also find links to our over 200 previous episodes of Skeptico, all there, downloadable for free. And that's also the place where you can drop me an email or click on over to my Facebook page. Tell me how you use the show, how you like the show, and offer up guest suggestions. You know, I've had more and more folks approach me about guests, and what I keep doing lately is saying, hey, great, if you'd like to see that person come on Skeptico, why don't you reach out to them and see if you can take that first step of inviting them and see if there's interest there, and then I'll follow up. So I have a number of interesting shows and some little mini projects coming up on Skeptico. A lot of things in the works and much to look forward to. But that is going to do it for this episode. Until next time, do take care and bye for now.